You are listening to History Man, a project of ekbarnes.com, where we walk in the footsteps of heroes and proclaim freedom reigns. On today's episode, we are very happy to have Mary Boyd, a historian at the Georgetown County Historical Society Museum in Georgetown, South Carolina. Welcome, Mary.
Hi, Eric. So glad to be with you all today.
And I'm so excited about being down here. Georgetown is just a wonderful little community, wonderful little town, and
yes,
it's the third oldest town in South Carolina.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That's correct. It's Charleston in 1670, Beaufort 1711, and Georgetown in 1729.
Wow. Before we start, we want to acknowledge a couple of our partners in this podcast. The Long Gone LLC in Camden, South Carolina, specializes in historic tours in the oldest continuous inland city of South Carolina. You can find them on Facebook at Long Gone LLC. We also want to recognize the Cultural and Heritage Museums of York County, South Carolina, including the Southern Revolutionary War Institute, and of course, our friends at SouthernCampaign1780.org. So thank you, Mary, for sitting down with us. Tell us a little bit about the background of Georgetown, South Carolina.
There is no little bit. It's 300 years worth of history here in Georgetown. One of the things we usually start off with is Native Americans, as do people all across America in their basic histories. But we even predate that. There was an attempted settlement here in 1526 by a Spanish explorer named Ayllon, who came with 600 settlers to the shores of where Georgetown later set up. However, 500 of the 600 settlers died of fever. The settlement lasted less than 1 year, and had that settlement been successful, though, we would have predated St. Augustine, Florida, as the oldest continuously occupied town in America. Well, it didn't happen.
Sure. So the Spanish that came here, you said Ayllon, did he come from Spain or Portugal? Or where
he came
from
somewhere in the Caribbean.
I see.
Via Spain, and he brought both Africans and other Spanish people here. In fact, he brought the very first enslaved people here. He brought the first horses that became known as what we call today the banker horses of North Carolina, the cracker horses of Florida. And in Georgetown, those that stayed in this area are the marsh tacky horses. You can see those out at Brook Green Gardens occasionally. They have a few of them that they bring out every once in a while. But sadly, it did not happen that way, and we didn't find a good footing until 1729.
So we have a large portion of our audience that listens to our podcast are from areas outside of South Carolina, Texas, California, New York, Michigan, that sort of. Give us a geographical kind of lesson about where Georgetown lies in South Carolina coast.
We are on the Atlantic coast of South Carolina. It's called the Low Country because of the low sea level here. We are 60 miles north of Charleston and 35 miles south of Myrtle Beach. Everyone knows Myrtle Beach, it would seem, even Seinfeld. and we are, I used to call us an undiscovered diamond, but we're being discovered daily and yearly by visitors. Wish we had more, and we welcome visitors to come in and enjoy the small town ambiance of Georgetown. We're not highly commercialized. We have an 8x4 block historic district that is the original 1729 area. It's shaded by live oak trees that were planted in 1900. And they are just a lovely canopy over the streets. We have houses along our streets that predate the Civil War, 66 in fact. And of those, 33 predate the Revolutionary War. So we have a wonderful walking tour map that is put out by the Chamber of Commerce, and people can really enjoy a small town ambiance in a very important historical setting.
It is a fascinating little town, and I noticed that on the wharf, the Harbor Walk,
right,
you have the tour boats just sitting right on the Harbor Walk right there. I mean, it is
right,
a beautiful stroll,
yep,
along the Sandpit River.
The Sandpit River.
And this community was situated where several rivers came together, correct?
That's exactly how we got started. In 1725, the town was laid out on the banks of the Sampit River. The Sampit is just 3 blocks from Winyaw Bay. And Winyaw Bay is 14 nautical miles from the mouth, at its mouth, to the Atlantic Ocean. So we were an international port of entry since 1732. Now, that didn't mean we had large ships coming in, even in those earliest days. Winyaw Bay is notoriously shallow, and sandbars that drift. And there is a major sandbar at the mouth of Winyaw Bay, which has restricted the big ships from coming in. So we never grew to the size that Charleston did, but we entertained ships from all over the world, the little small trading vessels that came in here.
And it still maintains its beauty. I was, some of the history, you had indigo trade was big here in the 1700s, is that right?
That was our first lucrative industry. Indigo came from the Caribbean through the family of Robert Lucas. His daughter was Eliza Lucas, who married Mr. Pinckney, and she is considered the indigo girl. She is the one who actually developed the cultivation of indigo in this area. They arrived in Charleston. 3 years later, Mr. Lucas had to go back to the Caribbean for military service, and he says, Eliza, at the age of 16, you're in charge. She experimented with the cultivation of indigo, successful after 2 years, and began to disperse the seeds in the area. The seeds came to Georgetown. She had one plantation up here that we know about, 2 in Charleston, 1 in Georgetown, and the indigo just took off here in Georgetown. From 1740 until 1790, Georgetown grew more indigo than anyone in the world. The British paid us a bounty to grow it exclusively for them for their Navy uniforms and for the royal robes. Indigo is a low-growing plant that gives off this dark blue-purple clothing dye. So the British were our only market for the indigo, and of course, when the Revolutionary War came along, that seemed to dry up pretty quickly.
Right. So what replaced the indigo?
The gentleman had to find something else to replace that lucrative crop, so they decided to go headlong into the rice culture. So from 1790 until 1861, rice was king in Georgetown. It vastly surpassed the value of the indigo. In fact, in the 1850s, Georgetown was the wealthiest county in the entire United States because of the growing of rice. Now, that said, every penny of the multi-millions of dollars that these wealthy growers earned, and every grain of rice of the more than 50 million pounds of rice that were exported from Georgetown were, of course, on the backs of the enslaved Africans.
Right.
The west coast of Africa was rice-growing area. So that is where the enslaved people that came to Georgetown came from, and they taught us how to do it. Little is said about their ingenuity, about their creativity, their artistry, and their engineering talents created what is known as a rice trunk, which is a floodgate system that they devised to control flooding and draining of the rice fields. As I mentioned, we have 66 houses in Georgetown that predate the war between the states and the Revolutionary War. Every single one of those were built by the enslaved Africans. They're still with us today. The only thing that takes these wonderful vintage houses is fire and neglect. We can't do too much about the fire. That happens accidentally. Neglect, we're trying to put a handle on that. But these beautiful homes have gorgeous hand-carved moldings in the main rooms of the houses, all of that done by the enslaved Africans. Also in the artistry there, the sweetgrass baskets are a South Carolina unique craft. They made these baskets in Africa, so the skill came over with them, and they continued to make them when they came into the colonies in slavery. The baskets are made of sweet grass, which is a beech grass, bulrush, and then they are all woven together with the fronds of our palmetto tree. One addition when they began making these here in the colonies is that they added pine needles. So there's a brown stripe running through a lot of the sweetgrass baskets today. Now, these were worth absolutely nothing. They were just utility baskets on the plantations. And then sometime during the mid-20th century, they got elevated to a folk art. And there went the dollar signs straight up. So it's a wonderful souvenir type thing that our visitors want to take home with them.
Just in a short time talking here, you have mentioned the Spanish, the Caribbean, the western side of Africa. We're talking about the British. When we talk about a melting pot, and we're talking about the founding of our nation, right? It is a melting pot from the very beginning.
And add into those cultures the French Huguenots that came early. The English, of course, were the first ones into Charleston. The French Huguenots were right there with them. The Presbyterians from Scotland came in. All of those settled Charleston. And gradually, they began to expand their horizons and came up to Georgetown. And also, the Jewish congregation in Charleston was the largest in the nation. And we had several of those families that came up to Georgetown. And they have been in the business class as well as the ruling class here in Georgetown. We have at least seven mayors over these 300 years that are from the Jewish congregation. So we have a real eclectic type of culture here in Georgetown.
Well, it shows forth just when you walk the streets of Georgetown. It shows forth in every corner you turn. And the food in the local restaurants. We ate in one of the local restaurants, and we're just blown away by the home-style cooking.
We're a seafood capital. That's one of our main industries here. So all of our restaurants feature seafood. And we have one that is a very interesting African-American cultural restaurant called Ani's that serves good old down-home cooking.
I see.
And that's really down-home cooking from the Gullah culture.
Is that right? Well, tell us a little bit about the museum.
The Georgetown County Museum started in 2008, and we moved to a new building in 2013, four times as big. We celebrate the 300 years of Georgetown history here in our two floors. We are free. We do have a donation box. Donations are greatly appreciated, but the Historical Society that runs this museum is solely funded by memberships, sales in our gift shops, our fundraisers, donations, and grants.
I see.
Yeah.
So when you walk through the museum, tell us a little bit about your exhibits that you have here.
Well, the first floor gallery is the timeline, and we start out with the Native Americans, and we go chronologically around the room, and ending up in the early 20th century. Now, we have eight American firsts here in Georgetown. It all started in the discovery in 1987 of the earliest recovered vessel in American waters. It's called the Brown's Ferry Vessel. It probably went down before 1740. And the discovery of that has helped scientists discover how shipbuilding methods were done in those early days. By 1735, we have the first banking house in the colony. Indigo, as we mentioned earlier, came in around 1740, and we were the largest indigo producer in the world. By 1757, those indigo growers had opened the first free school in America. That school is still with us today. The school building is just two blocks from the museum. It's today just a social hall. It's not a school anymore. 1908, the public school system started, so it was absorbed into that. On June 13th, 1777, the Marquis de Lafayette took his very first footsteps in the colonies right here in Georgetown. So we are really thrilled about that, and we like to play that up a good bit. From 1790 until 1861, we all have already talked about that the rice culture was prominent here in Georgetown. During the war between the states, we have the only Union flagship sunk in the war, the Harvest Moon, and it's out here in Winyah Bay. The smokestack of the Harvest Moon can still be seen out there. In 1868, Georgetown has the very first African American ever to go to Congress. His name is Joseph Hayne Rainey, and he served in the House of Representatives from 1868 to 1880. He returned to Georgetown, died in 1886, and sadly, we don't even know where he's buried.
Wow.
And then in 1899, the largest lumber mill in the United States opened. It became the largest by 1916 and went strongly with the huge lumber industry here in this area until 1932, when, of course, it succumbed to the Depression.
Tell our listeners about an annual event that you have every year.
We have an event, a culinary event called Cattails and Cocktails. It's our largest fundraiser for the museum at this time. Local hunters and fishermen prepare dishes of all local catch. We sell tickets. We have a silent auction and a raffle, things from our local businesses. It's just a really fun time on a Sunday afternoon. It's always on a Sunday afternoon so that the business people who are operating their businesses otherwise can attend. And it's just a fun event to have.
So when is that event?
It's in the spring, and sometimes it's been in late February, sometimes early March. 2 years ago, we had it in April, so it's a little bit of a floating festival.
Right. So how can they reach you and get information about these events and your museum?
You can go to our website, GeorgetownCountyMuseum.com. We are on Facebook, Georgetown County Museum History Center, where, by the way, we have stories of local history. We have over 200 articles that we have written for our local newspaper. It folded, sadly, so now we're putting those articles both on our website and in our Facebook feed. So we have lots of good history you can get to there. You can email us at info@GeorgetownCountyMuseum.com. And our telephone number is 843-545-7020.
That's some fascinating highlights of Georgetown, and we hope our listeners will tune in on our next episode. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Revolutionary War and the history here in Georgetown and the founding of our nation. So thank you so much, Mary.
My pleasure.